Accession number 18207, Reel 3.
Tom O'Reilly, Reel 3.
Yes, we were called to briefing, and the station commander was in office there, which was unusual. And very melodramatic, I always remember his words, "This is it, boys." And the invasion were on. And we were briefed as to when it was actually happening. And Kai Idem, again, I seem to be clubbed with Kai. He was a Yank on the squadron. But he was the one who introduced the short haircuts to the squadron. And at one particular time, we must have all looked like from Men from Mars or something, because we all followed Kai. He had a short, right the way throughout, you know, more or less bald.
Crew cut.
A crew cut, about over an eighth of an inch hair covering. And we all got the same while we're at Catania, I think. We had a photograph taken. I wish I had kept it. All in our May Wests, and all with all baldy nuts. You know, we looked like Men from Mars or something. But I was with Kai again, and we took off to do a convoy patrol. This was about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, and it was just coming light, but it was still dark, and lined up alongside Kai, took off, and a bumpy, bang, 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 as we took off, but I thought nothing about it, because we were on a grass runway anyway. Took off, and we done our convoy patrol. Again, my engine getting rougher and rougher as it went through, but I'll never forget that, the sight. A moonlit night as well, and looking down from the aircraft to see these little tiny dots silhouetted against the sea. You know, you could see them all pinned out, hundreds of them, you know, all heading across to France. And I thought, again, that thought stuck in my memory. And I could close my eyes, I could see it again. You know, it's funny how the other little things seem to kind of impress you, don't they?
Yes.
And that was the whole invasion.
But no action on that day?
No. Apart from a rough engine and emergency landing on route back, and I'd taken off. What had happened when I'd lined up in formation with Kai on the takeoff, I'd hit the grim lamps. You know, the line of grim lamps about so high. And my end of my prop had chopped some of these grim lamps away. And I finished up with 8 inches. 10 inches off the end of each prop plate, gone. And when I landed, I'm just trying to, I can't remember the aerodrome I landed at. But coming back, it was getting that rough, I didn't attempt to try and get back to the squadron. I went in and landed at this airfield. When I pulled in and was waved in, I said, the engines, when a lad come up, you know, they usually jump up on the main plane and help you out the cockpit. He said, I said, I don't know what's wrong, the engine's very rough. He said, I've seen your prop. No, and have a look at it, and it'd be about 8 inches off every prop plate. So I had to get transport back to the squadron from there. But another eventual little effort.
On the 10th.
I missed two important points, by the way. Twice in the desert, I crash landed. Forgot all about them. First time, run out of petrol on the firing range at Ismailia, OTU. I had to land with my wheels up on the sand on the range. And the second time, exactly the same thing had happened. On the OTU, you never ever checked. There's various pilots took the various aircraft out, you see, and you were up for about an hour at a time and so on. And they were kept refueled by the ground crews. So you never checked a Form 700 and the like. And being, I suppose, so used to seeing the things full all the time, I never even bothered to check your fuel as he flew. And I ran out of fuel a second time and ended up in the desert, wheels up, kind of in the desert. So I was getting quite a prying expert, really.
This was in hurricanes?
Yeah, in the hurricanes, in the desert twice with OTO.
I noticed from your logbook on June the 10th, 1944, you put Eastern Flank, Sword and Juno beaches, chased 40 EA.
Like, you know, I'm being sarcastic with myself there. I think I put like F, haven't I?
Like F, yes.
Like the swear word F, you know. The four-letter word.
Like fuck.
Yeah, I've been sarcastic with myself there, I think. We never chased 40. We had a few of our lads went for Burton on the beachhead patrols. Because Jerry was very crafty. He used to hide in the clouds and whip out and hit them and then scarper back away again. That's why we were informed not to be, you know, to keep our eyes about us all the time and to be alert, forever alert. But you were inclined to get a bit bored, you know, flying up and down the beaches type of thing when nothing was happening. But we were informed, you know, stay alert because one of the Aussies, Sammy Small, he went for a Burton. Oh, and Kai Adama by then had been gone for a Burton. Kai had been walloped. So he did gone with the Angels.
What was his surname? Kai what?
Kai Adama. Adama. I-D-E-M-A-A. Adama. American boy. American man.
And on the 19th, flying a Spitfire Mark 9, you put shipping patrol, Straff small convoy off The Hague.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. What happened there, we used to... we go across from... By then, we were at Coltishall. We moved from the 11 group, which was a southern area group, up to Coltishall, because we were all earmarked. Being the first squadron to have drop bombs from a Spitfire, we were earmarked for Spit 16s, which was a Spit dive bomber. Our intelligence then were very familiar. Oh, incidentally, while we were at Detling and Merst and the like, we used to do the buzz bombs, the old V1s. You know, we'd be having a crack at the buzz bombs all the time because they were coming across all the time. But they used to have areas that... In a circular pattern, so many miles from the centre of London, for say a mile and a half, would be fighter area, followed then by an anti-aircraft area, followed by a fighter area as you came into. So it was the easiest thing in the heat of the kind of chase. You could easily go fly into an anti-aircraft area, which means that you'd be getting clobbered or you're likely to get hit by your own aircraft, your anti-aircraft. So that used to be a little bit dicey there.
But you were just about to tell me about strafing this convoy off.
Oh, yeah. Well, we moved, we earmarked them for the Spit 16s. We weren't aware of them anyway, but the Spit 16 was the Spit dive bomber, the answer to the V2, you know, the rockets. The only answer that we had to them was dive bombing the sites to stop them being launched. And the reinforced main plane, a modified carburetor with a twin float. What else did they have? They had a low altitude supercharger cut in, and basically the main plane reinforced, so you could carry a 1,000-pound bomb, and low level you'd be a fairly effective fighter as well. But we were sent up to Coltishall in Norfolk then, because most of the V2 sites were along the Hague, all hidden, camouflaged in the Hague, and we were sent up to Coltishall. From Coltishall we used to scramble and come out over Holland and patrol up and down the area. If it was 10-10s cloud, for instance, and there was no dive bombing available, we'd look for shipping. Shipping for trains, for transport, things like that. And occasionally we'd catch a convoy coming down from Denmark area with used to bring iron ore down, I think, from Denmark. Well, we used to catch a convoy a few times coming down there, and we'd have a go at them. We used to have a readiness section. Would we scramble, for instance, from Coltishall, and we'd do a weather recce, Jim Crow. go over to Holland, and we'd radio back. If it was a clear day, literally a clear day, we'd radio B for Bertie. Okay, B for Bertie. B for Bertie was a full bomb load. In other words, the area was clear and there was plenty of targets to have a go at. So we carry a 500 pound bomb and two 250s on the Spit, so we'd have a 1,000 pound a bomb. If it was up to about, say anything from over 5 tenths, from 5 tenths or 4 tenths cloud up to about 8 tenths, okay for Roderick. Well, Roderick was an armed reconnaissance. We'd have a 90 gallon overload and just two 250 pound bombs, which meant we had the enough fuel to fly around, find a hole in the cloud cover, probably hit a target, look for trains, look for transport, hit bridges, anything like that. We had the fuel to kind of fly around and have the time to spend over the target so as we could search for a target and clobber it. That was okay for Roderick. And the other one was a full bomb load, okay for Bertie. If it was 10 tenths cloud, well, we just fly around and try and find a hole, try and find transport, try and find trains, try and find anything to kind of fire at, you know.
Was it easy to find targets?
Not too easy, no. In 10 tenths cloud, it was pretty grim, you know. Sometimes, you know, you'd kind of come through cloud, here's a target, and you'd suddenly find that the cloud base had really gone down low and you were more or less still in cloud, not out of it, and you'd have to pull up and get out of the way. Otherwise you could hit something, you know.
But did you personally dive bomb V2 sites?
Oh yeah, for about, had quite a few trips there. I must have had about 30 or 40 dive bombing trips to the V2 sites.
Would there be a rocket on the pad?
Well, we wouldn't know actually, but we'd hit the site itself, and we've actually been going down on a target when a rocket's actually taken off, and we've actually been able to see a rocket take off from a pad as it's kind of come up. They come up extremely. You've seen the aeronaut, the space things in America. America, they take off, they're very, very slow, and they accelerate. Well, a rocket was exactly the same way. They'd be slow, kind of taking off, and then suddenly accelerate and it'd be away. But we've actually been going down on a target adjacent when a rocket's come up from a target ahead of us. But you'd hit the rocket sites each time. Well, there used to be, they'd have all sorts of things pulled over the top of them, trees pulled over the top of the site itself, so as to try and camouflage, you see. But from the Dutch intelligence, we knew pretty well where most of these targets were, and we were able to identify them. We used to do, in bad weather, our ground staff used to call it a yo-yo site. Yo-yo state, I should say. We'd have 10 tenths cloud to start off with, which would be a write-off. We'd be stood down, and all of a sudden it starts to clear, and they'd say, okay for Roderick. So the lads would stick a 90-gallon overload tank with two 250s, and we'd be waiting for a scramble from ops. You see, well, it wouldn't come. Next message would come through, it's cleared a bit more, so it's okay for Bertie. So they'd run out and drop the 90 overload tank and put a 500-pound bomb. Then it'd start to cloud before we took off and got off the deck. It crowd over again. We get another message, okay for Roderick. So they come out and take the 500-pound bomb off and put a tank on. And the lads used to put it on the ops board by dispersal. It'd be written off yo-yo state. That's what it meant. The yo-yo state was more or less the weather was changing that quick that ops couldn't make up their mind whether they wanted a full bomb load or a reconnaissance. So they used to think of the 500-pound bomb being like a yo-yo, being up and down, up and down, up and down, like a yo-yo. So the lads used to call it a yo-yo state. But we used to fly off from Coltishall and from Ludham, you know. When the front line went beyond Belgium, we used to go from Coltishall as the first light, hit a target, go down to Ursel or Maldegem in Belgium. We'd go for rebriefing. By the time we're rebriefed, the ground staff would reload, they'd rearm the aircraft and refuel it. We'd take off from there and hit another target and go back again. and we'd be up and down pretty well all day long, hitting V2 sites, and then the last trip we'd take and come back to Blighty. But it used to be quite a dicey job, you know. Initially, when we used to attack a target, we'd come in usually line astern, line echelon. If we were going for a target on our, say, port side, and the wind was coming from that direction, well, we'd come up on starboard, we'd starboard line astern, and you go in that way, one after the other, that way down there. Well, very quickly, Jerry caught on to which target we were after. So it used to be extremely heavy flak over there. All the V1 sites used to be covered.
V2 sites?
The V2 sites used to be covered with a hell of a lot of flak. Bomber boys used to either climb over the top or go around it. But what they used to do, they'd put a curtain of flak up from... They'd know for accuracy, we used to... You couldn't let your legs go under, I would say, about 4,000 feet indicated. But 4,000 feet would be, in fact, about anything from 2,000 to 1,000 foot. No, it would be more than that. Say 2,500 to 1,500 feet. In true, because you'd have altimeter lag. You'd be coming down faster than what the machine could record your height, you see. So you'd be indicated 4,000, but you'd be down to about 2,500. Well, Jerry very quickly realised that we'd have to get below a certain level in order for accuracy. So what they used to do then, they put a complete kind of sheet of flak, all fused to go off at various levels to cover from about 1,000 foot up to about 4,500 foot. So in order to get accuracy, you'd have to actually go through this. They tried to distract us, so we either let it go beforehand and was inaccurate, or we take a chance and come through the flak. Well, we used to have to go through it, you know. It used to be quite a, quite something, you know. When you more or less, you're hanging on your seatbelt anyway and going down like the clappers, and you see this old wall of white smoke coming up at you, and you know you got to go through that anyway to let your legs go. I don't know, unconsciously you kind of tend to close your eyes when you first hit the smoke, you know. Well, the smoke was actually flak, you know. And you have to go through it like eggs go. And then you had one or two things. Either you'd try and pull out quick and get away at a reasonable height, or keep on going. So we took you right down on the deck, and by that time you were going like the clappers, and Jerry would have he'd have a heck of a job trying to laying off to try and hit you, you know. Because you'd be going that fast, you'd be more or less, you know, just steeple level. Right.
Like, how much damage do you think you did to the V2 sites?
Well, I think we were fairly successful. I would think so. Because we were on that right up to the end of the armistice. So I shouldn't have really kept us at it if we weren't having some effect at it, you know.
But I suppose there was no question of actually shooting at the rockets as they were taking.
Oh, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. No. The only hope or the main aim behind it was just stop them being damaging the sites so they couldn't be launched, you know. And actually, mind you, it's an awful long story, so I don't want you getting involved with that. I've actually met a young Dutchman who was about, I think he was 11 year old when we were actually dive bombing these sites, and he remembers a Spitz dive bombing. He lived quite close. I've met this lad since, you know, and it was very interesting to get his views of what it was like on the ground, and he was equally keen to get my views as what it was like from the air. But I've met this lad, and I've also been privileged in meeting the leader of the Dutch underground, which to me was a great honour, you know.
In your logbook, you put duty Jim Crow.
A weather reconnaissance, yeah. That's a code word for a weather reconnaissance. That's when we got clobbered with flak on that particular time, and my number two went in, John Manley, who was a roommate of mine, you know.
You put, I was hit, went in hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you go in hospital?
Yeah, Manston. I was diverted to Manston from coming back. This happened over Holland, you know.
What wound did you have?
Oh, I had a piece went through my hand, a piece of flak went right through on the control column, you know. And I had a shell hit my oleo leg as well. That had gone, you know.
Did they keep you in hospital?
Yeah, I was in about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that.
That seemed to happen on 15th of September.
Yeah. John went in. He went into the North Sea. We were scrambled. What happened? We were on early readiness, and as I say, the format used to be the readiness would be scrambled to do a Jim Crow and radio back as to what the cloud base was like over Holland, you know, for the day's actions against the V2s. And John and I took off, and we were heading for hoping to hit landfall about 6 miles south of Almuyden. But there must have been a wind change to some degree, because we kept on our compass course, but we finished. And then it was 10-10's cloud anyway, but we finished up almost smack over Almuyden. But we presumed we'd be about 6 miles south. And by that time, we'd come down to about 1,000 foot, something like that. And we were in Vic formation. Well, if we'd have thought for a second where we were, truly where we were, we wouldn't have been anything like that. And when we turned off to come off the coast again, once we realised we'd hit landfall, and to turn off again, we were smack over in Moyden. And, of course, in Moyden was very heavily fortified. The Dutch used to know that as the coast of steel, because there were that many AK-AK guns. And it was just like hell let loose, you know, Dante's Inferno. There was bloody tracers and flak going on all over the place. And unfortunately, John got a shell right through the one side of his fuselage and more or less exploded behind his armour plating and blew the opposite side out. It was like the top of a pepper pot, you know, with holes in it. And his rudder and aileron control was just flapping in the breeze. So he was only keeping airborne, flying on the trims, what you call the trims, you know. They're just kind of minor aerofoils on the aileron and the rudder, you know, set on the main rudder, which is controlled by a stretch wire from the control point. And he was keeping them on that. So in other words, his rudder turned left and right was inoperable, and his ailerons, that's banking either way, they were inoperable. So he was kind of getting airborne on these controls only. The only thing he could do was his climb and dive, you know, his elevators were still working. But he was also hitting the engine. So eventually I heard John call out Mayday, you know, and no, he called to me, I'm afraid. Yeah, he called to me and said he'd been hit. But his compass had gone as well. And I said, well, Alf, where were you? And when I spotted him, he got to about 2,500 foot. You can understand when you get hit like that and you get in a flak, it's every man for himself. You take a phase of action whichever way you can go. And I finished up, I don't know, about 4,500 foot, something like that, way back. I didn't know what had happened to me, kind of thing. And then when kind of the penny dropped and my senses kind of levelled off, I heard John call me and I spotted him. He was to my starboard. I was alongside him and I could see these rudder things floating in the breeze. And he said, rudder in on control, gone, heading west. No, or will you head west? That was it. His compass had gone. So I headed west and we just got off the coast and he said, I'll have to bail. So I called Mayday, Mayday right out and with a Spitfire. There's only two ways of getting out of a spit. One is you've let your canopy go, you've got shut of your straps, right, and you roll on your back. I beg your pardon, you keep your straps on, you let your canopy go, and make sure your wireless plugs out, and roll on your back. Right? And as you roll on your back, you kick your stick forward, right, and pull your straps and drop out upside down that way. Right? Either that way, or you pull up and what you call your trim nose heavy, but hang on to your stick, and in the last minute you just hold your hand at the top by your, you know, keep you clear of your gun sight, which is right smack in front. top of your canopy and kick the stick forward. So you're actually going along like that, and then you knock your nose right down and you shoot out that way, you know. But you've got to have full control to be able to do that. Otherwise, there's no point in just dropping on the front and sliding on the front. And it was very difficult for John, having run an aeron control gun for a bit. And I know he tried, it looked as if he tried to roll on his back. But as he went back, he went into an inverted spin. In other words, he was spinning upside down, going down. So all the air pressure was back into his cockpit. And I don't think he got, because just before he hit the drink, I just saw a little glimpse of white. So I think he's pulled his chute, trying to get out. He's not been able to get out properly. He's pulled his chute, trying to get out. But he unfortunately didn't get out. He went in, you know. But I found out where he was buried in Germany at some later date. And meanwhile, a chap who had written a book on activity against enemy shipping off the Dutch coast, he's in one of the universities over there. What's his name? He's all written. He does aeronautical pieces and things like that. Dutch chap, university man. He'd written to me somehow. I don't know how he got my name, but he'd written to me asking for my impressions of what had happened, all the rest of it. And I then said that I'd found out where John had gone in, and I'd like to visit, you know, the grave. And if I went over there, would he have anybody who could kind of direct me to this place? And better than that, he said, well, I've got what do you call these fellows? That kind of investigate on your behalf.
A researcher.
Terrible when you get old, isn't it? You forget all these phrases.
A researcher.
A researcher. He had a researcher down in Emoyden, you know, which is quite near to this place. I can't remember the other place now, but near Emoyden. And he said he'd only be too happy to direct you, but he'd be very interested in meeting you anyway, because he was a 12-year-old boy at the time, quite close to the V2 sites, and he remembers the Spitfires dive bombing the sites, and he'd very much like to meet you, type of thing. So, long story short, went over, met this chap and his wife with my wife, and we went and visited John's grave, you know, and sent a photograph off to his sisters in America.
You put in your logbook that the 29th of November was the first time you'd flown since your accident.
Yeah. How long was it in hospital? I don't know. I don't know.
Sounds like maybe several weeks, anyway.
Yeah.
And you said fired at again, quite a nice feeling.
Referring to the flak, I think.
And then you said, first prang since I first joined a squadron. Do you remember that prang? December the 9th?
December. No, I don't.
But then you said bombed Leiden, four direct hits.
Oh, Leiden, yeah. we'd done a diversionary attack on, I think it was Leiden. Leiden, I think, is in the north of Holland. And there's a bay, quite a big bay around there, and I think they'd spotted quite a big convoy coming down from Denver, and